Good morning. I would like to introduce to you and welcome Father John Corbett Opie. He was born in 1951 in Columbus, Ohio. He graduated from the Providence College in 1973 and was ordained as a Dominican priest in 1980. He received a doctorate in sacred theology from Fribourg University in Switzerland. He has taught moral theology at Providence College, the Josephinum in Columbus, and the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. for many years. He is currently helping both in the novitiate with spiritual direction for Dominican friars in the Eastern Province and at St. Gertrude Church in Cincinnati with mass, preaching, and confession. Father Corbett is rather famous among the Dominican brothers and sisters, not only as a great teacher with a sense of humor, but as one with great spiritual depth. I was blessed to have him as my retreat master in April 2021. It is a blessing to have him for our day of recollection today. Thank you for being with us, Father.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a great honor to be with you. I always like to come to Nashville. The nuns are so wonderful and hospitable, and the people I talk to, the Dominican fraternities there, are great too. It's a nice trip, and besides, you have to get away from novices every once in a while. Anyway, if I were to ask you, what for the medieval mind would be the most perfect geometric shape? I know this is not the most burning of questions. but if I were to pose the question anyway, what would the answer be? And the answer would be a circle. A circle is the perfect shape. Middle-aged guys like to say the pear is the perfect shape. But the medievals knew better. It's a circle. Why? Because the circle, the beginning point is always the end point, so that it's hard to tell beginning and end. That it's circular, and there's everything in a way is beginning, and everything is an ending. It's a perfect shape. Well, I want to suggest this morning that when we're talking about the Imago Dei and teaching about that in the scriptures, and more generally with scripture as a whole, we're dealing with the medieval perfect shape. We're dealing with a circle. Now, how so? Well, where does the Bible begin? What's the very first order of business for the Genesis? Well, it's to build a temple. No, it isn't, you say. It's to build a world, right? Stars, sun, creeping things on the earth, all of that. It's not a temple, it's a world. Is this? Oh, okay, thank you. But notice that the Bible begins, I'll argue the point that the Genesis really does begin with the construction of a temple. And how does the Bible end? It ends, for all practical purposes, in chapter 21 and the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation. And what happens? What's the climactic ending? It's the descent from heaven, from God, of the holy city. Well, where is there a temple in that? In the holy city that descends the New Jerusalem, there's no need for a temple. Why? Because its temple is the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb. There is no temple because the whole place is a temple, because the whole place is alight with the presence of God. And how is it described? Just a few verses earlier, it's described this way. Behold, the dwelling of God is with men, He will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them. That's it. That's the whole beginning and the end of Revelation. So I said at the beginning that Genesis begins with the building of the temple. How does that ring true? Doesn't Genesis begin with the creation of the world?
Well, no.
It does. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, right? And it talks about a seven-day process of creation where God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be a firmament between the waters above and the waters below, and so it was. And let there be lands separated by the firmament, and let that land teem with life, and so forth. The creation of the world is described, but is it described in a scientific fashion? And of course, we've wasted so much ink, not this particular period of time, but in the 19th century, and with the Scopes monkey trial and all of that, we've wasted so much time on trying to defend Genesis as a scientific account of the world, when it's clear by its genre that it was never intended to be a scientific account of the origin of things. When God made, it's not a scientific treatise then. If you try to make it scientific, just like if you try to make the book of Revelation a prediction of next month's or year's political events, which some people do, you know. I've met them. Well, it's hard to make any headway in that kind of conversation when you're misunderstanding the genre of the book you're reading. You're going to miss the whole point. Okay, so it's not a scientific treatise. But then, what is it? Well, the other go-to answer, which a lot of people find enough, is that the Bible is a figurative way of teaching a basic truth. And the figurative way that it teaches the truth is to, by images, say that God made everything. If you see that tree out there, God made it. If you see that fence post, God made it. See that ornery neighbor, God made him too. See the earth, sea, skies, lands, and dinosaurs, God made them too. If there were any dinosaurs to see. All right, so you see that it's all about God making and being the origin of everything. Now, is that wrong? No. That's right, God is the origin of everything, and Genesis does teach that. But is that all it teaches? And the answer, I think, is definitely no. The Genesis teaching is that when God made the world, he made it to be his temple. That is, it's a place where he and his people could be together, where his people could be with him. Well, how do we know that? Is the word temple in the first chapter of Genesis? No, it's not. Well, then how do we know that he's talking about the temple? Clue number one. Creation in Genesis is treated as a seven-day event. And the number seven is a sacred number, and it figures prominently in ancient Near Eastern temples. The mythology of the surrounding temples to Israel would be that they were all built in 7 days. It's one of the marks of a temple, is that it's built in 7 days. And sometimes these temples, when they were dedicated, would be dedicated with 7-day feasts. So you have 7 days to build the temple, and you have 7 days to feast and party, to celebrate, to dedicate the giving of the temple. So 1 Kings 6:38 has the temple in Jerusalem following that pattern when it was built. It was built in 7 years and was dedicated to God in the midst of a 7-day feast. So the number 7 tells us that when God made the world in 7 days, there are definitely temple-like overtones to that teaching, okay? So really, if you were going to ask which is closer to the truth, Genesis 1 was written by a scientist or Genesis 1 was written by a liturgist, they bet on the liturgist. That's the kind of thing that it is, okay? Now, the rest of God, this is the second clue, and it has to do with God resting on the seventh day. It says that the God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And on the seventh day, God rested from all of his work. Now, this is interesting because, again, surrounding Canaanite religion always depicted the gods that they worshipped as having their temple dedicated and then always going to sleep in their temple after it was dedicated. I guess apparently having a temple dedicated in your honor is exhausting work. Anyway, the gods found it exhausting because after they had endured 7 days of speeches and ribbon cuttings and all the rest of it, with the mayor there handing out cigars and all the rest of that, you would weary of it too. You would say, I gotta take a break, you know. And anyway, the Canaanite deities always took a break after the people dedicated their temple to them. And so this is what happens here. The neighboring gods slept in their temple after it was dedicated, and God rests after, if you follow the argument, this God, the Lord, rests after the whole world has been completed and has been dedicated to him. See? Also, there's another reason to think that Genesis 1 is really about making the earth be the temple of the Lord. It has to do with specialized vocabulary. In Genesis 1, when God makes the sun and the moon, what does he call them? He calls them lights. Now, the same word is used, and it's a technical word, the same word in Hebrew is used to describe the lamps of the tabernacle in the desert, see? There's a word that means lamp in a sanctuary, in a place of worship, and it's that specific word that is used to describe the stars and the sun and the moon. It's sun and moon and stars help keep a calendar, and keeping a calendar is important because it helps you keep liturgical feasts. So that's what is really going on. The lights in the sky are really the lamps in the temple. Also, the word seasons. There is a general Hebrew word for spring, summer, winter, and fall, but that isn't the word they use when they're talking about the seasons in the day of creation. It's the word that is used for liturgical feasts. When you say God made the seasons, you're really saying he made the liturgical feasts that celebrate his divine action. Okay. Now, there are a couple of other texts that suggest that there is a close connection between the temple and the creation of the world. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 1. It's a verse that teaches that God is present in all creation, that God isn't limited to the temple, but in fact, he fills the heavens and the earth. And that verse, Isaiah 66:1, strongly suggests that the reason God made the world to begin with is to fill it, to flood it, with his glorious presence. Whenever you have the temple being dedicated, there's often talk about a shadow or the Shekinah, the glory coming from the Lord down upon the temple. And that's what's being talked about here. The temple is flooded with the glorious presence of God when the Shekinah comes down. But that is only a foreshadowing of God's ultimate intention, which is to flood the whole cosmos, to flood the whole universe with his glorious presence in a perceptible, strikingly evident and glorious way. This is very much like the last chapter in Revelation, where the city of God, resplendent from God, with light from God, descends from heaven to the earth. It's the same inspiration, it's the same teaching. Why did God make you? He made you to know, love him, serve him, and be happy with him in this life and the next. Serve him in this life, be happy with him in the next. Why did God make the cosmos? To flood it with his glory. And where is the cosmos symbolized? Where is the presence of God in the world most acutely symbolized? It's in the temple, see? So whenever we go into a church, this is what one of the things we should, and this is a very old memory, but one of the things that we should always have in the back of our minds and spirits is that when we go into a church, we're not just going to a place where the presence of God is reserved, we're also going into a space which is a prophecy. That just as God fills this church with his presence in the Blessed Sacrament, so God will one day fill the world, the whole cosmos, with his visible presence. This is otherwise known as the parousia. And every church that we have should in some way or other say this. It doesn't mean every church has to be explicitly dedicated to the parousia, but it does mean that the ancients weren't wrong in holding that both time and place have a sacred character, that time and place can mediate the divine presence. Set aside time and place can mediate the divine presence and the divine glory. That's been the Catholic instinct from the beginning. That's why we have altar rails. That's why we have sanctuary lamps. It's why we have reserved spaces. And why, I'm editorializing now a little bit. You have to forgive it. But why attempts to remove the Blessed Sacrament, to sort of desanctify the church, to make more room for the people so that the people will know that they are the center of interest, is a profound theological mistake. Unfortunately, neither you nor I are the main center of interest. Now, priests are subject to this temptation more than other people, I think. Most lay people can get away with being quietly megalomaniacs in the church, not conspicuously megalomaniacs. But you know, there was a way in which priests would preside, sometimes anyway, in the 80s, in the era when I was ordained. And it was, remember, what was the name of that guy who had the talk show? Phil Donahue. Any of you remember Phil Donahue? Okay, well, anyway, the celebrant sometimes would behave like Phil Donahue. Hello, everyone! How are we today? You try to engage the not the congregation or the people of God, but the audience with a kind of line of patter, and you draw them in and you make everybody feel cozy and at home, and everyone knows that the purpose of this is entertainment. Is this worship? No. No, it's far removed from worship. It doesn't have anything to do with worship. Even the people of God who are called together explicitly to be the people of God, and in that sense are the center of God's attention, the only point of that, the only point of liturgy is to break out of that into a more broad cosmic praise of God, where all of the earth, all of the earth and all of the cosmos's praises are gathered together in the persons of the liturgy, the persons who celebrate the liturgy, priests and people. You know, we're really a spokesperson. You see what I mean? We give a voice, we give thoughts, we give expression to something that all of creation, really in its deepest layers, is doing, singing the praise of God. See? So there really is a close and profound link between the creation of the world and the worship of God in the temple. Just as God floods the temple with his presence, so one day he will fill the earth. Now, what is man's role in this context? How are we the image in this context? Well, our job, according to this vision, is to further the flooding of creation with God's presence. Now, I want to share five passages from the Old Testament that explicitly deal with the image of God. The first one is Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 27. And Elohim said, "Let us make the Adam, the man, in our image, as our likeness, that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and the tame beasts and all the earth and all the creeping things creeping on the earth." And Elohim created the Adam in his image. In the image of Elohim, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Just to recap in a sentence or two what I've been saying, man, the human person, Adam, male and female, Adam and Eve, is the last created in the climax of of the priestly creation narrative. As we've seen, the author of Genesis 1 has Leviticus's priestly interest in the liturgical calendar with the reference to the moon and stars, as well as every beast classified and placed in proper order. That order in the right order is very important to a priestly mentality. And the book of Leviticus spends lots and lots of time classifying jellyfish and birds and all of that, which to me has, you know, I suppose a gastronomical interest. If they're particularly good oysters, that might perk my interest. But otherwise not. But the point of the author of this book is that God made every living thing, which in some way resembles him because it's living, to have order and integrity and a place. Everything, the unclean thing for Genesis and Leviticus is an animal that's a mixture of two kinds. What he likes is animal types clean and well-defined and separate from each other. It's all part of an orderly world, see? Okay. So there are liturgical elements in the foundations for worship on the Sabbath because after the creation, God rests and says of his creation, it is good. And he affirms his creation in affirming man when he gives him even a higher grade. Not only was the creation of man good, it was very good. Okay, now, I want to say something about this dominion. Let us make Adam in our image as our likeness, that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens Okay, that they may rule. Now, there's a couple of ways of interpreting that. One way that has been used in the past, and I think is still powerful for many, is the idea that this gives us carte blanche to do with the creation what we want. In other words, the idea of some has been that, to put it in philosophical language, everything that is created that is subhuman has only a utilitarian interest. See? Everything that is made for our specific use, which means that although we may have a sentimental attachment to my friend Flicka, if it comes down between me and Flicka, Flicka ends up as horse meat. You know, too bad, Flicka. Rawr, he goes, sorry, but you are for my dominion, you know. Or the fish of the sea. I mean, is there an ethical problem in fishing all the tuna out? Now, I mean, this is a matter of biblical teaching that we do have dominion over the earth, but that I don't think that implies that we've got permission to just destroy every species but our own. First of all, because that would amount to destroying ourselves. If you destroy the environment, you destroy yourself as well. We're part of we transcend the environment, but we're also part of it, right? So, well, what is the rule then? Remember that God doesn't need to rule. I'll talk about this in the next talk, but you know, one of the benefits of being God is that you don't need anything else. You know, I mean, you are in yourself the fullness of being, therefore the fullness of goodness, therefore what else? Fullness of knowledge, fullness of love, and if you make something, it doesn't add a single bit to your own goodness. You're just as good after you create as you were before. You are not improved by the act of creating. Now, we're different. We have to make things, do things. If we don't, we simply atrophy. We need activity and we need other things to complete our activity. But God isn't like that. He doesn't need to do anything, and he's still God. So when there's an old folk hymn that goes like, it's an African-American spiritual, and it's a poem, I think a song too, and it begins, "I'm lonely," said God, "I'll make me a world." Now that's lovely poetry, but it's bad theology. Can you imagine an omnipotent needy person? "Hello, George. This is God again. I need to talk to you. I need some more appreciation from you. I've been noticing you've been lagging. Yes, God, I know. You called me last week about this. I know, but I just wanted to make the point, you know. Praise me some more, please. I'm getting lonely up here." Ridiculous, right? I mean, it'd be scary, you know. I mean, once it's sort of, there was once a movie, Supergirl, I think it was, and it depicted her as somebody who got needy for a boyfriend, and the boyfriend was terrified of her. Well, that's how, if God is needy, we should be terrified of him. But he doesn't need to create. He just wants to. Why? To gain goodness? No. To communicate it. To share it. And that's how he rules. His style isn't to say, "Na na 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 na, I'm in charge of a world and I can do whatever I like with it, including destroy it." That's an empty satisfaction. The point of his rule, just like the point of any action of his, is to communicate, to share his own goodness. Not to lord it over creation, but to enable it to flourish. It's not an accident, I think, that Adam is described as the gardener of Eden rather than the architect of Eden. you know. He makes, what does a gardener do? He makes things grow. And you don't make things grow by reading books like Get Down and Tough with Your Plants. Show your pants, plants who's boss, you know. Getting tough with tulips. It's not going to work. I mean, if you treat your plants like that, they'll die, they'll wither, they won't flourish. The point of God as God is, it's the Thomas Aquinas says, the proper effect of God as God, that is an effect which he shares with no one else, is that he makes to be. He is and he makes to be, and it doesn't diminish him in the least to do it. So, he makes to be, and that means that Adam, who is supposed to rule in God's name, is therefore part sent to further God's project of making things be so that he dwells completely and manifestly in the whole of his temple, which is the cosmos, his shared presence with his creatures. See? Adam's role is to help that along. All right. So that's why we want to say that Adam is, as the image of God, is the royal representative of God, extending God's care to everything that was made. Now, that's the first text. So the next text is and from Genesis chapter 5. This is verses 1 through 3. Let me read it to you briefly. This is the list of the generations of Adam. On the day that Elohim created Adam, he created him in the image of Elohim. Male and female, he created them. And he blessed them, and he called their name Adam on the day were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and he begot in his likeness as his image, and he called his name Seth. All right, a couple of brief things to say about this use of the image. Adam is the image of God. Notice where this story is placed, or this verses are placed. They are placed in chapter 5, which is after the account of Genesis 3, which deals with the fall. See? Genesis 3 describes the catastrophe that began with the serpent. All right? Now, after that, I'll go back and talk about that in more detail in a bit, but the fall, suffice it to say for now, that Adam and Eve rebelled, fell into sin, and this introduced death into the world. Not right away, but it did introduce death. There was a whole series of events which illustrate dramatically the consequences of the fall, which is the spreading of evil. Okay. Now, that's the consequence of the fall, and you would think that it would destroy the human race. After all, the fall was threatened with the penalty of death. But after all of that, you see, this is the list of the generations of Adam. Well, how come there are generations of Adam? I thought he was supposed to die. Well, he's still around. On the day that Elohim created him, he created him in the image of Elohim, male and female, he created them. And what happens? Well, not only does the image of God not destroyed right away, he gives birth to a new image of himself and therefore of God. And the name of that new image was Seth. And how long did Adam live? 130 years. And he begot in his likeness and his image, and he called his son Seth. Seth is the proof that humanity isn't done yet. Seth is the promise. He's born after the fall, but he is born after the image,
And the strategic placing of this account is to make the point that even after the fall, and even after the flood, and even after Lamech murdering Seven, and even after all the other catastrophes unleashed by the fall, it shows that man's sin has not obliterated the divine image in the human person. So when we do our worst, we still can't destroy what God has in mind for us, which is a consoling thing to know. Okay, Genesis 9, verses 6 through 7. This is kind of a gruesome text, but let me read it to you anyway. He who sheds the blood of the Adam, by Adam his blood will be shed. For in the image of Elohim he made the Adam. But you, be fruitful, be many, swarm on the earth and rule on it. Well, this is another dimension of being the image of God. It means that God addresses you. Notice the words, but you, be fruitful. Who? You. Adam. Me? Yes, you. You. I'm talking to you. That's one of the things that it means to be a human being, that you are made by God capable of receiving a divine address. I said that creation praises God, and it does. I mean, when we sing the Psalms, it's not just you and I that are singing them, but because you and I have molecules and atoms and minerals and all that have their origin in the Big Bang. I mean, if you trace this back far enough, vestiges of matter that cling to us are traceable to the cosmos, right? So it's in a true sense, when we pray and praise, the whole cosmos is in us, represented in us, also praying and praising. But the only reason creation can do that is that we're here. If we weren't here to give voice to creation's praises, then creation would be mute, you know? In other words, creation really wouldn't be complete without us. And we who are addressed then by God are addressed by God in a way that nothing else in creation, material creation, can be. God will say to us, but you, but he never says to the rocks, at least as a personal agent, but you. Now, Jesus does in a certain way. I mean, you could say that Jesus addressed the fig tree, you know, may you never bear fruit again, and of course, but that's simply a command over nature. It's not really an address to a person. Jesus wasn't waiting for the response of the fig tree to see if it had any rebuttal to offer, you know? He wasn't. He wasn't looking for a response, and that's one of the reasons why. And anything that's subpersonal can't give a subpersonal response. So when God says to Adam, but you, be fruitful, be many, in the form of an address, he's not addressing him as an equal, but he is addressing him as a subject and therefore somehow removed from all the rest of the sphere of nature. Now this is tied, so Adam is addressed personally, and this personal address is tied by this text to his rule as royal representative. His being addressed by God as God's royal representative on earth is tied to his intrinsic royal dignity. He who sheds the blood of the Adam, by Adam his blood will be shed. Here's the privilege. Man is protected by God precisely because he's his image. Even sinful people are protected by God. It's true that there is capital punishment that is spoken of in this text. If you kill, you will be killed. But the intent of that verse, I believe, is not to settle the question of capital punishment, although some people have argued that it is. I don't think it's about capital punishment. I think it's about the privileged status of the human being who has the blood of life in him and is marked by God, even as Cain was, by God's special protection. When you deal with human beings, you're dealing with holy ground. You're dealing with sacred territory. So that in a sense, murdering people is not only unjust, it's also a sacrilege. Okay, let me go ahead. There's two more texts here that are of notice. Sirach, chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. The Lord created man out of earth and made him into his own image. He turned him back into earth again, but clothed him in strength like his own. He gave to men a few days, a limited time, but granted them authority over the things upon the earth. He placed the fear of them in all flesh and granted them dominion over beasts and birds he made for them, discretion with a tongue and eyes and ears. He gave them mind for thinking and filled them with the discipline of discernment. He created in them the knowledge of the Spirit. He filled their hearts with understanding and showed them good and evil. This verse and the next one that I'm going to talk to you about move closer to the contemporary Catholic dogmatic teaching about the image of God. If you were to ask a biblical author, why is man the image of God? He would have said he's his royal representative on earth, extending his care for creation. If you ask Thomas Aquinas why human beings are in the image and likeness of God, it's because they have a mind and will. See, it's because we're intelligent and free that we resemble God. Now, as I say, this is a kind of a, I want to say pathetic, but that's not the right word. It's a sad, it's a bittersweet, let's put it that way. It's a bittersweet description of human beings as the image of God, because we're born and in a few days we are headed to the funeral parlor, you know. We live our life vigorously and then before you know it, the undertaker is asking our relatives if we would like to be cremated. You know. Ugh. But anyway, that's it. You know, dust to dust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Back to earth. But the other side of this, he clothed him in strength like his own. Again, you have the contrast. He gave them a few days, not much time, but granted them authority over the things upon the earth. Here you have the rightful authority of man as the image of God again. He gave them dominion over beasts and birds. He gave them discretion. He's made us intelligent with speech and with our eyes and ears. Open your eyes, open your ears, learn. He gave them mind for thinking. He created them the knowledge of the Spirit. He gave their heart understanding and showed them good and evil, the true and the good. That's why we're the image of God, because we know and can know something as true and know something as good, not just something as appetible or not appetible. See what I mean? Okay. All right, one more. This is the last verse on the image of God, man as the image of God in the Old Testament. This is the wisdom of Solomon. This is a famous passage, chapter 2, verses 21 through 24. Thus they reasoned, but they were led astray. For their wickedness blinded them, and they did not know the secret purposes of God. Nor did they hope for the wages of holiness, nor discern the prize for blameless souls. For God created man for incorruption and made him the image of his own eternity. Let me read that again. He made him in the image of his own eternity. But through the devil's envy, death entered the world, and those who belong to his party experience it. It's interesting. This is also bittersweet because the Imago Dei here is linked to a frankly despairing assessment of the human being. Not the authors, but thus they reasoned. And what were they reasoning? Well, they reasoned that the world doesn't mean anything, and that their life is senseless, and that therefore the only sane thing to do is to make time while we can, and to live even with reference to injustice. Excuse me, just a minute. Ezekiel, Daniel, Wisdom of Solomon. Here we go, chapter 2. For they reasoned unsoundly, saying to themselves, short and sorrowful is our life, and there is no remedy for when a man comes to his end, and no one has been known to return from Hades. Because we were born by mere chance, and hereafter we shall be as though we had never been. Because the breath in our nostrils is smoke, and reason is a spark kindled by the beating of our hearts. When it is extinguished, the body will turn to ashes, and the spirit will dissolve like empty air. Our name will be forgotten in time, and no one will remember our works. Our life will pass away like the traces of a cloud and be scattered like mist that is chased by the rays of the sun and overcome by its heat. For our allotted time is the passing of a shadow, and there is no return from our death because it is sealed up and no one turns back. Therefore what? Therefore, let us enjoy the good things that exist and make use of the creation to the full as in youth. Let us take our fill of costly wine and perfumes and let no flower of spring pass by us. Let us crown ourselves with rosebuds before they wither and so forth. But then things get much darker. Let us oppress the righteous poor man. Let us not spare the widow, nor regard the gray hairs of the aged. Let our might be our law of right, for what is weak proves itself to be useless. Let us lie in wait for the righteous man, because he is inconvenient to us, and so on and so forth. This man is telling us that we're wrong. We're wrong about how we're living. We've based our life on a lie. See, we've based our life on the idea that there's no real point to being good, that it's all a waste, that our life is smoke. Believing that, what's the logical extension of that? Well, according to the wisdom of Solomon, it's let us oppress the just man because he's making our lives a lot harder than it would otherwise be. So, the wisdom of God, then, the image of God here, is especially located in the man who wants to affirm the purposes of the Creator in making a human being, that God saw what he made, saw that it was good, and that there is, in fact, a reward for the just man. Okay. They did not discern the prize for blameless souls, for God created man for incorruption. In other words, this experience of injustice that they're going through, that they are in fact bringing about, this injustice is going to be defeated because man has been created for incorruption and made in the image of his own eternity. You see, the protection from evil is made to consist in immortality, and the immortality that he experiences is God's ultimate vindication of the just. The vindication of being just is tied to being the image of God. If you're authentically the image of God, you will suffer injustice, you will suffer persecution, but you will be vindicated because, in fact, there's something indestructible in you. They will try to destroy, but they will not be able to, because you, as the image of God, because of your mind and your freedom, are spiritual, and because God is with you, you will not be vanquished. So you see that there is the image of God here is tied to the experience of evil and overcoming evil through confidence in the power of God who made us his image to begin with. Does that make sense? Okay, that's all I have to say for the first. Have I been going on for half an hour or 40 minutes? Pardon?
Yes.
Okay. All right, well, I will take a break and then we'll come back for more of the same.